large number of dBs, otherwise your receiver becomes jammed and overloaded with your own transmitter power. So it's a little bit like standing in the middle of your living room on a dark night with a flash camera in your hand, and through that picture window, you want to take a picture of the deer that's out in front on your lawn. Well, that flash camera is going to give you a lot of reflection off the glass, and you may not see what's beyond it. By the same token, the echo from your own antenna, or the leakage from your own antenna, can be blinding your
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Those various things can be blinding your receiver, and it takes extra techniques to get around that. In the case of the Height Finder radar, what it was doing is using a sawtooth sweep of frequency. It was sweeping up and down in frequency, and the echo off the ground is delayed in time. The echo comes back at a time shifted, which really means frequency shifted, and by the difference between the transmit frequency and the receive frequency on that sawtooth sweeping radar, the difference in those frequencies tells you how many thousand feet you are above the ground. So it was a very effective kind of radar. So the word radar, there's a zillion kinds of radars. You open up Skolnick's Radar Handbook. It's a real classic on the subject. And I don't know what printing it's in right now, but it's updated periodically. The Red Book, as I call it. The Skolnick also has a Introduction to Radar, but the Radar Handbook, I'm guessing it has 35 chapters, which to some degree are telling you 35 different kinds of radar. The word radar is a very ubiquitous word. There's lots and lots of kinds of radars. And so to study those are some real good state-of-the-art electronics that have definite ham radio applications, and it teaches you an awful lot about transmitters, receivers, antennas, feed lines, isolation techniques, and whatever, duty factors and sensitivities. The number of words in the vocabulary of a radar man and the number of words in the vocabulary of a good radio man are kind of amazing, if you know what I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, what about the resolution, the aperture resolution? Which has a better resolving power to be able to identify a shape?
And you're now getting into what I call the imaging radars. And there's a whole art and science to doing that. You probably know a little bit about what goes on with the kind of optical interferometer, which is called a, I can't think of the name of it now. These three-dimensional optical pictures that you can get nowadays with laser sources and, I can't think of the name of those things. You know the ones I'm talking about?
Hologram?
You got it, hologram. What you can do with an optical hologram and what you can do with the right kind of a radar, the right kind of a radar with the right kind of modulation and processing can do holography. And by a holographic-like process, you can get a crude picture of what's inside that black box. I've got an insulated black box, which is radar transparent. Inside I've got some kind of an object. And with the right kind of a radar, I can do a kind of holography, and I can get an image of what's inside that black box. Or by the same token, I can get a kind of an image of what kind of an aircraft is flying into my territory. The wavelengths involved, you want to go to higher and higher frequencies, which have smaller and smaller wavelengths, which give you the capability of greater and greater resolution. That hologram you look at is using wavelengths that are extremely small compared to your eye's angular resolution. Therefore, you can get an extremely high resolution three-dimensional image with a hologram. In the case of radars that are operating at, let me talk frequency, X-band, 10 gigahertz, where the wavelength is 1 inch, you're probably not, without very special techniques, going to resolve anything on that target smaller than an inch. Well, if I'm trying to resolve the wings and tail and fuselage of an airplane, if I could do it to the nearest foot, I'd be happy. And yes, it's doable. No, it is not easy. A kind of synthetic aperture radar is one of the techniques that does imaging. That's the kind of a radar that does side-looking as it flies over a territory, and it literally gives you a image of the territory you've flown over that looks almost like a photograph. So these are some of the techniques. Synthetic aperture, holography, and there were others. But that's a whole art and science in itself, and there's lots and lots of books written on that one. Not Eastman.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Not necessarily easy to understand, John, but a beautiful area to investigate. Again, you've only heard 1% of the story, KC2WGB. I only know 10% of the story, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick, because I was wondering a few years ago with Raytheon, we worked on a radar unit that was on a 52-foot Hatteras, that we were actually able to see the limbs and the leaves on trees on the shore. And I was just amazed at the resolution. I don't know what type they were using. It was a little hush-hush, but I was just looking to get a little tip on that. Thank you very much for your lengthy discussion there and explanation.
Yeah, there's a lot more to the story. Right now, I think we should go over to Mel's mailbag and what kind of burning questions have you received this week, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, good evening again, everyone. Hope you're all having a great Memorial Weekend. The weather surely is great, cooperative. But again, I always say every year, remember what this holiday is really all about. It's more than just a good shopping day or day to picnic and barbecue and all. There's a lot more to it, so think of what the real meaning of it is. All right, with that, let's see. Let me find something here. Hold on one. I'm going to get a drop, and then I'll read this one. Okay. My antenna wire broke. I have a long wire antenna. What is the best way to put it back together? What do you do? Just twist them together and solder? Or is there a special way that you know to repair a long wire that has got broken in the wind? It's a good question. Which way would you do it, Dick?
Quite often we build our long wire antennas and our 80-meter dipoles and the 40-meter dipoles out of something very convenient like 14-gauge household wire. Most of the time we strip away the rubber, but you don't necessarily have to. And if it's been out in the weather for a long time, it probably has a lot of copper oxide on it. So those two ends that are broken that you want to rejoin, I would first, in my case, rub them with emery cloth or very fine sandpaper or steel wool or whatever. I would scrape away some of the copper oxide for two reasons. One, I'd like when I twist them together to make very good contact. There's something called a lineman splice, I think it is, where you literally lay the two wires in a collinear manner with an overlap.
Western Union splice.
There you go, Western Union splice. So I lay the two wires in a collinear manner, in other words, end to end, so to speak, but I overlap them, and maybe the overlap is about 3 inches, and then I simply twist. It's called the Western Union splice. Twist them nice and tight, and it tends to make a mechanically very strong joint. And just doing that most of the time is sufficient. But if you want to use the Cadillac approach, then you solder it. And the combination of having used some kind of abrasive material on the wire to get rid of the copper oxide before putting them together, then twisting them, and then soldering them, you not only get an extremely good electrical contact, you get an extremely good mechanical contact from both the twisting action as well as the soldering action. And to do soldering outdoors, my favorite way to do it is a soldering iron tip that's placed on the end of a burn-thematic torch. But that's just me. There's other ways that can be done. The one minor problem you might have to worry about, if it was an 80-meter dipole, and now you've spliced 3 inches of the wire, 3 inches on 80 meters as change in length is an extremely minor one, and probably you're not going to see any real change in standing wave ratio, even if you did. To clip another piece of wire on the end near the insulator to re-extend it electronically is a very easy thing to do. And the high voltage and very low current, let me drop... The high voltage and very low currents that you get at the tip of a dipole are such that you don't even have to make good contact. You simply go out there with a short clip lead and clip it onto the wire. And you've electronically changed the length, and you can go back in the shack and remeasure the VISWR and see if you're going in the right direction. So in the case of a long wire, you usually don't worry about the exact length. In the case of a dipole, you might. But mechanically rejoining the wire is pretty easy. A neophyte guy might think that when the wire was completely whole, as it was in the very beginning, it's going to give you the highest performance. And you're going to start worrying that because I've got a splice, I've got this lump, that things bad are going to happen. Absolutely not. If you calculate the diameter of that splice that you just made, it's probably 1/10,000th of a wavelength that RF energy cannot even tell that you've made a splice, as long as you've made a pretty good contact and your ohmmeter would reveal that to you real fast if you've got any doubt. These are some of my feelings on that subject. I bet you've spliced a few pieces of wire in your time, particularly when you made your own homebrew open wire transmission line. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
That was my call sign, but I do have an answer for you, Dick.
Yeah, let me go over to Mel first. I got everything mixed up, as you can tell. Mel first, and then John in that order. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. That's all right, Dick. I didn't know what you meant, but I let Sean pick it up, figured that maybe he wants to make a comment first. I was always splicing wires, I guess, by a different method. I'd make two loops, you know, put two loops together, make two eye loops, put them together, and then solder it. I thought maybe that makes a stronger bond, but you say that interwoving them, sort of braiding them together and then soldering it, is a better way to go. I'm not sure, really. I don't know. Let me hear what John has to say. Go ahead, John.
That is so famous as the so-called Western Union splice. I'll bet you, because of its effectiveness, that's why it has that classic name. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
You're absolutely right, Dick. But there is an improvement to it. A very simple piece of copper tubing, 1/8 inch. You just stick the wires at both ends, use your state con crimper, crimp it, and then flow the solder just like you said. The wire stays the same length, and it's mechanically sound.
Question. When they do it that way with a piece of tubing, do they still call it a Western Union splice? What do they call it, John?
That's a bus splice.
Okay, Wesley, go ahead.
So I was thinking, and I wonder what is your response in this area. In Europe, what people were doing, they were not using a typical solder. They were using a brass. Was it any different? Back to you.
You're saying they were not using solder, they were using a brass.
That's brazing.
Okay, brazing. The good news about brazing is that it's definitely stronger than solder. The bad news is it requires much higher temperatures. For a person who's well-equipped, go to it. But in the case of solder, when you've made a Western Union splice and you've got so darn many inches of length over which the solder is giving you strength, I am almost positive you could take a Western Union splice with solder, put it into a tensile testing machine, and I think that that spliced area will probably give you a higher tensile strength than the native wire. What do you think on that one, John? Go ahead.
You're right, Dick. Just like a weld, the metal will fail, not the weld. And solder is not used for strength. That's only for electrical conductivity, but the Western Union splice is horrendously effective.
But the reason that brazing was utilized in Eastern Europe was because it did not increase the average area of the splice and did not require really to go to the bending of the wires in order to increase the mechanical strength. But
it's for a person who's very skilled with welding and brazing, I guess you could almost do a butt joint. In other words, the two ends are brought together, and now the bonding takes place by the brazing or welding process. So you're not adding or subtracting any length to the wire. That's the good news. However, in most cases, brazing and welding are done at such temperatures that the local annealing and thermal hardening of the materials creates a change. If I was welding two pieces of steel together, first of all, if it was, say, for instance, a galvanized ham radio tower, where I did the welding, the temperatures are so high that all of the galvanizing would be gone, and the local steel would have a brand new hardness because of the temperature event it went through. So you got to do something else to make sure that the local hardening that you may have created with the welding process does not create the potential of a stress fracture at a later time. I'm probably worrying about minor details, but the way you protect the joint after you've done the brazing or welding, and the way that you do re-annealing if required, is another step you've got to consider if you want to get the, everything back to the way it used to be.
Yeah, I have a question in this area. I did not understand, because you mentioned a different piece of material. In Eastern Europe, we were not using anything else for the antennas as a copper. If you can mention about different materials and their properties in terms of the antennas. Thank you.
KC2, QIQ.
Glenn recognized. There's a kind of steel based copper covered wire. Can't think of the name of the stuff right now.
Copper weld.
There it is, copper weld. So copper weld is a popular material that has a lot of mechanical strength, and it has a lot of electrical performance, because at radio frequencies you always get what's called the skin effect, for reasons that are a little bit mysterious at first. At most of the radio frequencies we care about, the RF signal never goes below about 1/10,000th of an inch of the copper. Your particular copper conductor might be a quarter of an inch in diameter, and now you start adding up all of the cross-section of that copper, and you start calculating how much current you can put through it. Well, at 60 cycles, you've got a pretty good answer. At 3 megacycles, that answer doesn't work at all, because whether you're using a piece of copper tubing or a solid chunk of copper, the RF characteristics are almost identical, because the RF doesn't go any deeper than just the outer skin. Who had a further comment on this one? K2RIW?
K2GJE, Ed.
Jed, Ed is going to be right after Glenn. KC2QIQ, go right ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I was just listening in about the brazing, which I think is kind of interesting, but I was just, I don't think I was ever able to braze copper. I can see the steel wire. You can probably get a braze onto it, but do you think it's possible actually to braze copper, Dick? One of the reasons why I think we use solder with copper most of the time, unless you're using some kind of steel. But I think that actually the copper would probably melt at the brazing temperatures. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Here we're using silver solder, not brazing.
Okay, there are various kinds of higher temperature, harder materials that are used in a brazing-like process. So when it comes to joining metals in something that looks like welding or brazing, there's lots and lots of materials, and that's another whole art and science. Ed, Mr. GJE, give me your full call letters again, Ed, and your comment. K2RAW, my name is Dick.
Kilo 2, Golf, Juliet, Echo, Dick, over.
Go right ahead with your comment, Ed.
Your method of splicing by twisting the two wires axially is half the Western Union splice. That doesn't have that much strength if it isn't soldered. The original Western Union splice was to twist the two wires axially, and then you leave some wire left over and you wrap it around each end radially, over.
Now, I know how you twist the middle section. I know you've got some wire left over on both sides because you left a pigtail. And then what do you do with those pigtails? You said twist them radially. Wouldn't I have to re-bring them back together in order to twist them in a radial manner instead of an axial manner? Back to you, Ed.
No, we now have two ends. They may be an inch or two apart. They're at, let's say, 90 degrees to the antenna run, and now you start to twist them around the wire as if you were making a coil around the wire separately on each end of the twisted section. Over.
I'm getting the picture, Ed. Very similar to the way you do what's called serving of the individual strands at the end of a piece of guy wire. After you've run your piece of guy wire around the eye that has a symbol on it, and you've brought it back upon itself, and you've now put guy clips on it, and you put probably three guy clips on that guy wire, holding the folded around end together, then the individual strands get separated one at a time, and they get wrapped around the whole guy wire, and they call that serving. So you serve the ends of the individual strands of your guy wire in order to get maximum strength and reliability. And I think you're saying in the so-called Western Union splice, a very similar process takes place, and it looks like serving. Is that approximately true, Ed? Go right ahead, Ed.
Yes, it is, except now we're just serving with only one wire on each end. Over.
Comment on brazing.
And I'm getting the picture on that one, Ed. If, for instance, you didn't do a very good wrapping job, you didn't wrap a long enough length in the splice, and if there's not enough friction of the materials, and if the tension on the wire starts pulling that splice apart, eventually you end up on those two tightly wrapped, coiled, served ends, and now the thing will not proceed any further, and it jams and doesn't unwind. Is approximately that the real strength of the Western Union splice from your point of view? Ed, go ahead.
Yes, correct. 100%. Over.
Go ahead on your extra words on brazing, Wesley.
Yeah, well, actually, the brazing that we were doing was done with the material that was containing silver and copper and cadmium. Sometimes zinc, but not all the time. In a military application, yes, we had a zinc into that. And it was in color of very much similar to the brace, and extremely well holding. And that was not only useful for this purpose, it came actually from the tool industry. And they were using carbide and ceramics to be covered with the same exactly plating of the material. One of the guys after the Second World War in Russia started to experiment with that, and then it became kind of industry standard. Back to you, sir.
As you guys are hearing, when it comes to high temperature and hardened solders, there's a large number of things that are called solder, large number of materials that are called brazing materials. There's a zillion different alloys. As you add silver to solder, for instance, silver content solder, silver bearing solder, I think it's called, it tends to get more and more hardened, stronger and stronger, but it tends to require higher and higher temperatures, with rare exception. So it pays your money, it takes your choice as to what temperature you're going to subject your materials to. You may think that you want something stronger than solder when you're soldering down surface mount components to your printed circuit board. Well, there they tend not to use some of these exotic materials because the high temperatures could create damage to either the printed circuit board itself or to the electronics. Then again, there are other materials. There are low temperature solders, but you got to be careful of those. Some of the low temperature solders require rather caustic flux materials in order to make a good bond. And if you don't do an extremely good washing job afterward, the acetic materials, the caustic materials, can in the next year or so crawl through the leads of the plastic package or even the ceramic package of your chunk of electronics, eventually get in there and destroy the actual die, the actual chunk of integrated circuit inside. And I've seen that happen, where a year or two downrange you start getting mysterious failures because somebody didn't properly wash away the fluxing materials that we use with these exotic kinds of solder. K2KEY, K2RIW, back to you, Mel.
Hey, very interesting. Yeah. This is a number of methods that can be employed, and no doubt if you're going to get a lot of failures, maybe your wire is too tight. You know, that's another thing. Hams have a tendency, young hams, have a tendency to tighten the wire up considerably, Dick. Make it very taunt because, you know, when you look in a book, they show you an antenna wire perfectly straight. But there's no reason for it to have to be torn. It to be have a sag in it so that it can flex around in the wind a little bit. And so if you have a counterweight over a pulley that keeps it so-called torn, just adjust it so that it doesn't pull that much on the wire that it's, you know, that it's making it stretch so tight that that the wind can easily fatigue and break it. I guess that's a common misnomer that the wire has to be torn, Dick, over.
WA2ZOZ. WA2ZOZ, recognize. The book shows you the wire straight out, and in the case of a center-fed dipole, it really could be a V-shaped or an inverted V-shape. There's nothing magic about straight. We all look at a tree as a steady object, and we completely forget about the fact when high wind blows, that tree might very well tilt itself over at a 30-degree angle with no damage to the tree. So the amount of motion of a tree up at the altitudes where we connect our antennas is so huge, it's a mind-blower. I can remember some of the dipoles that I strung in the trees on my property, oak trees, and I remember adding more and more springs at the ends of the dipole in order to accommodate the tree. And no matter what I did, the tree on a windy day would eventually move far enough to break the spring. So some people do it by way of a pulley and a weight in order to accommodate, but you gotta recognize the fact that the tree is really a very movable object, even though you tend not to be out there at the time that it's moving that much and you don't see it. It moves. ZOZ, if you've got a comment on all of the above, or if you want to be added to the list, give me your words on that. Right, start off with your name, sir. WA2ZOZ, I think it is, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
And WS2N.
Paul recognized. Mr. ZOZ, go ahead.
Good evening, everyone. This is Don Delta Oscar November, Whiskey Alpha 2, Zulu Oscar Zulu, Norwood, New Jersey. I would like to be on the list. I have a question on mobile radio.
Very fine, Don. We'll add you to the list. Paul, go ahead with your comment.
Okay, yeah. Dick, I think you have this book, Thinking Physics. There's a one experiment or one example that they use in that book. They talk about stretching a cable or a wire, whatever it is, and you know, how taut you know something could be. You know, how much strength you have to put to pull on something to take the sag out of something. And they have all these vector numbers involved and this and that. But by the time you get to the point where this thing is supposed to be almost straight, and according to this guy, you know, as long as there's gravity, you're not gonna make this thing straight no matter what you do. You'll wind up with millions of pounds of force, and you're still never gonna get that 100%. It won't be exactly like a laser beam. I don't know if you remember that little chat that they have in there, but that was pretty good in Thinking Physics. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, all of a sudden, I've forgotten the author's name. Do you have the book in front of you? We can tell me the author's name.
It's probably about 3 feet away from me. 1 second. Okay, Dick. Yeah, Lewis Carroll Epstein. Yeah, Thinking Physics.
Yeah, that's an extremely good book, Epstein. And I think he's a professor in University of Louisiana or someplace like that, or maybe it's California. Anyhow, Thinking Physics is a gray paperback book. I think it's in its third printing. It's in its third edition, 27th printing. Very popular book. If you like physics at all, you'll love that book. Each individual page has got a stick figure with a multiple choice question. got a diagram on each page and multiple point choice questions, and boy, does that teach you physics. I wish the physics book that I was giving in college worked that way. Very, very friendly. Let me drop. And so that book, which costs you about $30 nowadays, in my opinion, is definitely worth it. And what Paul is bringing to our attention is that when you look at the simple diagram in a book for a dipole where the wire is perfectly parallel to the ground, and you've got a piece of transmission line hanging in the center, and thinking physics will lead you to believe that, will tell you straight out, you take any length of cord or wire and put a weight in the middle of it, and ask the question, how tight must it be for the string to be straight, for the wire to be straight? And the answer is it'll never get there. As the tension on the wire goes to infinity, it becomes straighter, but never gets there. It's a asymptotic relationship. If the wire of your guy wire on a tower had zero stretch to it, and if it was tight enough to be completely straight, and you got in the middle of that guy wire and put your weight on it, even though the guy wire in my case is good for 6,650 pounds, so-called 6M guy wire, a very popular material used by LiPo, Loco, Con Ed, whatever, for guying their telephone poles, their utility poles, 6M cable. 6,650 is the rated strength of that cable. And you might have that guy wire stretched to 3,000 pounds. And if it had no additional stretch to it, and you hung your weight from the middle of it, and in my case, let's assume I'm a 200-pound man, in theory, the amount of tension I would create would go to many thousands of pounds, and I would create a failure. In reality, the wire really is a piece of rubber band, even though you don't think so. On a couple of the towers I've worked on, a very long piece of wire, even though it's extremely tight with all kinds of thousands of pounds, if you're on a 300-foot tower and you move your weight back and forth at the 300-foot level, you're able to move that tower.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And you'll start asking yourself the question, how in the world am I able to do this? It's got 10,000 pounds of tension on each one of those guy wires, and here I am moving my body back and forth closer and further away from the tower, and I'm moving the tower. Well, that particular guy wire may be 600 feet long, and it stretches, even though you don't think so. You talk to the people who work on an aircraft carrier. If that arresting wire ever breaks while it's arresting an airplane, and during the arresting process there might be 100,000 or 500,000 pounds of force on that wire, and if that wire comes apart at one end, the stretch of that wire like a rubber band is such that it will now spring back. It'll probably move at close to the speed of sound, and I'm not kidding. It will slice through anything that's on that deck that's in its way. If you're there, you're just a minor perturbation. It'll just go slicing right through your body. Very dangerous thing. By the same token, a rope or a wire that is holding a great big ship to the shore, and if the wind blows the ship and it starts going out at an angle and that wire becomes tight, and you think that, well, it's well attached to the boat and it's well attached to the mooring on the shore, no problem. You better not be there. If it should break, that nylon rope or that piece of wire, whatever it is, when it finally hits breaking strength, the remaining stretch it went through and the contraction it will go through will move it at a speed that will definitely do an awful lot of damage if you're in the area. It looks innocent. It's not. Okay. I know we're getting off subject, Mel. You probably got at least two or three more you want to go to. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good. This is K2KEY. Yeah, fascinating subject, physics to begin with, and then, like you say, things like guy wires and all. Be careful. Especially field days coming up. Every year we hear of situations that develop with injuries, unfortunately, especially with antennas and electrical wiring for field day. Don't take anything for granted. It all looks innocent, but any of it could become a disaster real quick. All right, here's one. Let me drop it, and then we'll read it. Okay. You're constantly talking about the D, E, and F layers or regions of the ionosphere. Is there such a thing as the A, B, and C regions? Do they really exist? That's a good question. I'm thinking about that, Dick. I got to get my thoughts correct. Is there such a thing as the ABC? Over.
I think the answer is no. It's a tradition. A, B, and C were probably letters that were already used in the alphabet for amperes and battery and charge on a capacitor, capacitance. They had already used those letters, is my guess. And when they started talking about the heavy side layer, the ionosphere, and all the other words they used for it, the lowest layer is the D, the next one is the E, and the next one is above that is the F, F1 and F2. So it's a combination of tradition, and I don't think there ever was an A, B, and C, because the D layer, to my knowledge, really goes all the way down to the ground. And we don't talk about layers below the ground. So I don't think there was an A, B, and C, Mel. K2GEY, K2RIW.
Okay, Roger, I believe the same thing. In other words, to set it straight, there is no ionospheric region lower than the D region. Am I correct?
That's my understanding. I think the D layer goes all the way down to the ground. Well, not quite. Because to really be ionosphere, it has to be ionized. And does the level of ionization go all the way down to the ground? I think it doesn't. And the reason for that, well, it's one of these relativistic things. When ultraviolet rays come out of the sun and strike an air molecule, the energy it imparts to that air molecule can very easily make a single electron leave that air molecule. When an electron leaves that air molecule, the electron is negatively charged, the rest of the molecule is, relatively speaking, positively charged, and you've now got an ionized material. That's what ionization is. It's got charge and separation between the individual components of the atom, the oxygen atom in this case. How long does it take for that electron that's running around to find a free oxygen ion where, you know, it's also lacking an electron and they join up again? A so-called mean free path is a function of air pressure. If the air pressure is higher where the individual atoms are closer together, they recombine real fast. So I am guessing that each ultraviolet ray that manages to get all the way down to the surface of the Earth, got to go through a lot of air molecules to get there, the few that get there and create ionization, the ionization is so extremely brief, the recombination takes place so fast, that you really don't call it ionosphere down low. There's got to be some amount of altitude where the air is getting a little bit thinner when you really get an ionosphere. But if I plotted ionization versus altitude, I don't think there's an absolute abrupt stop.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Intuition.
I don't think there's an absolutely abruptly stopping altitude. I think it's one of these asymptotic decay-like things. So is there an ionosphere 100 feet above the ground? I kind of doubt it, but if you had real good instrumentation, I may be able to measure a tiny bit of ionization. What's your feeling on this one, Wesley?
1 pPa. Intuition. I'm kind of confused because you were sending quite a few times in terms of the energy distribution. When the photon comes from the sun, hits the first molecule of air, and then it becomes the mass reach and is represented by the electron. Now, we know that based on the science, the photon does not have a mass. So, when I was watching that video that I have sent you and that was from 1957, I believe, the ionization energy chemistry study that was material for the students for United States Army. Ladies and gentlemen, I was looking at all of this experimentation, then I said, okay, how about if we send the radio wave up into the space? After the radio wave that carries on the mass, because it is represented by the electrons, by the mass, when it leaves the atmosphere, does then this radio wave is represented by the photon as an energy carrier? And also, if the electron is not immune to the magnetic field of the magnet, that's what we have when we deal with that experience from that video that I have sent to you, and also with the waveguides that utilize magnets, is then the magnetic, electromagnetic wave in the air immune or not immune to the magnetic field? Back to you.
Dick, no electrons are transmitted. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. A radio wave does not consist of electrons. Wesley, you've asked a question or made statements that represent four separate phenomena, and you've combined it all into one, I'm going to call it mishmash.
Yes, I understand. I use improper wording, but John Understand is my translator.
Yeah, we're going to discuss this in the more serious section later on. This, what you're asking right now, there's four separate questions wound in there, and this is off subject of what Mel was asking. So I think there's essentially no real significant ionization of the D layer down low, and I'm going to make a guess that the ionization has to take place a couple of miles up before it is significant in the D layer. Is my guess. There was a person who signed in from a much longer distance with a very weak signal. Who was that? If you've got a something to add on this particular subject, give me your call letters and name, sir. K2RIW.
You one Victor, Victor Hotel.
How you doing, Mr. Chase? And I mailed you. By the way, if you go to QRZ.com, anybody who's listening to me, and you go to Whiskey Alpha One Victor Victor Hotel, and you see his website, you'll see a beautiful picture of a Rhone 55 tower, which I think is something like 170 feet tall. And he's got a picture looking down through his feet. And you go to, you click on the picture and you expand it to a much larger picture. Beautiful looking thing. And so I want to find that picture on Google Earth. And so he's 170 miles away. I just did the calculation a few minutes ago. And so how's the signal getting up there tonight? K2RIW, go ahead.
Yeah, much QSB. I'm not going to be able to stay on the Q cell. Very unsettled tonight. However, as usual, I'm hearing the repeater probably better than I'm getting in. Back to you.
Yeah, you sound beautiful to us, Harold. That's WA1DVH. Go to QRZ.com, look in the upper right-hand corner of his picture and click on it. From my tower, I see pictures somewhat like that. And so he and I are mailing tower pictures back and forth to each other, trying to wow each other with our high-altitude pictures. Okay, glad you signed in, Harold, and come back as often as you can. Mel, you want to go to another one of your questions? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet, and the mailbag section.
Okay, I'll just say a final word about this. The E, if I remember correctly, just say, let me just make sure I tell you where the E, I think, originally came from. About 100 years ago, when they first started to find that the discovery of the short, so-called short wave skip, the existence of this reflective region high in the atmosphere, I believe they coined the name ionosphere at the time. However, that region was named E. The letter E came up for the electrostatic, for radio waves as electrostatic. I believe that's where E came from as the reference for E, Dick. I hope I'm not throwing anybody off, but that's what I recollect, over.
Yeah, I'm not sure on that one, Mel. But for all the years I've been reading electronic radio propagation books, magazines, and whatever, starting in the early 50s, seems like they always mention the D, the Delta, the Echo, and the Foxtrot regions. And these are various levels of altitude and levels of ionization. Ionization means that you've made a plasma. You've separated electrons from the rest of the nucleus and the rest of the atom, and as such it's now a conducting medium. And so that ionosphere is a conducting plasma medium, which has all kinds of characteristics to radio waves, as far as refraction, reflection, and diffraction is concerned. And it also has effects on the ultraviolet rays that come out of the sun. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, like ultraviolet, near and far ultraviolet from the sun, each individual photon, by the Planck equation, E equals H nu, the Planck equation where H is the Planck constant, as you go to higher and higher frequencies, there's more and more energy for each individual, the smallest possible particle of energy of that wave that we call a photon. And so those higher ultraviolet, higher frequency ultraviolet rays can do all kinds of things. It gives you a sunburn, it creates the ionosphere. The ionosphere changes drastically at nighttime because the sun is no longer shining on that part of the Earth and no longer giving you this ultraviolet exposure. Why don't you go to at least one more, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I'll go to one more. I've just looked at one here, and this is, I like to go to auctions and other sales where you get so-called bargains. One of the ones I went to recently, I saw this nice instrument that nobody seemed to really know what it was, nor really cared to bid on, so I gave them just a couple dollar bid, which I easily got the instrument. It's basically called a frequency selective level meter. What is it? Do I have any use? Is it any use in ham radio? Go ahead, Dick.
Why don't you start off on that one, Mel? I bet you own some of these. Tell us what you know on that subject.
What do I know about the subject? That's a good question. Frequency selective level meter. I'll take a shot at it. It basically is what? A selective voltmeter, and used for what? Well, measuring ranges of, I think in, what the heck were they made for? They're measuring in dBm, I think. I gotta think about it, Dick. But I think that's what it is. It's known as the frequency selective voltmeter. Does that sound reasonable, over?
Yes, it does. Each of the grid dip meters I have owned, Heathkit and Millen, I think is the brand name, or is it? Can't think of the brand name of the other one. Anyhow. Each of them have a grid dip mode and a rectifier mode, a wave meter mode. In the grid dip meter mode, you've got this external coil on this thing you hold in your hand. You've got a dial that you turn, which determines what frequency it oscillates at. And you've got a meter somewhere that tells you what is the strength of the oscillation. When you take that coil, which has, let me say, let's assume that I've got 3.5 megacycles running on this grid dip meter right now, and I hold it near the dipole of a 80-meter antenna, 132 feet of wire. Because the dipole is resonant at 3.5 megacycles, and my grid dip meter is running at 3.5 megacycles, Mother Nature just loves to couple things that are resonated at the same frequency. So the dipole is running, is resonating at the frequency, it's a tuned circuit, so to speak, and my grid dip meter is running at that frequency, so some of the energy jumps off the end of that coil, goes onto the dipole, and gets radiated in space. Because there is less energy left for that oscillation, the rectifier circuit on the oscillator has a smaller amount of voltage, and you'll see the meter, which represents energy magnitude, dip. You'll see it go to the left. And as you scoot the dial in frequency higher and lower, and you get the maximum dip, you're now finding out the exact frequency that your dipole resonates at, or it could be a inductor capacitor circuit that's resonating, and you'll find out the frequency it resonates at. Well, that's in the grid dip meter mode. There was another mode you could flip a switch on the Heathkit grid dip meter, as I remember, which was a wave meter mode, where it did the exact same rectification, but it turned off its oscillator.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, somebody just told us that Ico also built one of those, and I think General Radio did too. General Radio, Ico, Millen, Heathkit, various brand names. And when you go over to the wave meter mode, it stops oscillating, but still the rectifier in the meter is still active. And now if you bring it near an oscillating circuit, and you scoot the dial back and forth, you're now doing the whole process in reverse. Again, energy couples between the two circuits. Gets picked up by the tuned circuit in your hand, the grid dip meter, so to speak, but it's running in the wave meter mode, and as energy gets coupled into it, and the rectifier sees that energy, the meter now goes upscale instead of downscale. So now you scoot the dial back and forth until you see the maximum deflection when you're in the wave meter mode. So that I would call an absorptive wave meter. So there are various instruments that have different names, but essentially that function. Either a grid dip meter or wave meter, telling you the frequency of resonance or the frequency of oscillation. The nice thing about these circuits, in the case of a wave meter, I believe it does not respond to harmonics. I think it does not. So in other words, as long as your oscillator is pure and you scoot that dial back and forth in the wave meter mode, you'll find out, in theory, what frequency your oscillator is running at. And even if you tune to twice the frequency or half the frequency, the meter will not respond. It only responds to the fundamental. It'll respond if there really is harmonic energy in your oscillator, but that's another whole story. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, thank you, Paul.
Extremely weak signal that had something like Tibet Zulu, but that's all I heard. Over to you, Mel. Quebec Golf Zulu. Okay, Bill, go right ahead.
Okay, I've got a crappy spot, so real quick. A lot of those devices were used in telco for measuring individual carriers in an FDM box, either from demodulated microwave or coaxial. That way the frequency selective level meter would let you look at the individual subcarriers in the HF box if it was demodulated. And WB2QGS.
So I think you're saying, Bill, that when you were doing remote, what is it called now? You were doing remote base setup, so to speak, for the broadcast industry. You could actually study the energy that was in your baseband of your system by instrumentation like that. Is that sort of what you were saying, Bill? Back to you, Bill.
Not in my instance. They were typically used for void circuits, for long-distance void circuits in the days of microwave and coaxial carrier. And that way you'd look at the individual voice circuits out of the box.
Okay, you look at the individual voice circuits out of the mux. Mux means multiplexing, so where individual frequencies are being mixed together in a multiplexing circuit, and you want to find out which of those voice channels are present, an absorptive wave meter tuning across that band, kind of a poor man's spectrum analyzer, would tell you, that particular voice circuit is operational right now, so I think Bill is saying. K2KEY, K2RIW, you got it, Mel.
Okay, so we tell him that he has an amateur radio application with this thing, or is it just going to be something he's going to say looks impressive sitting on a shelf?
Well, an awful lot of the things I bought, I had no use for them. Like one of them has a chunk of waveguide with all kinds of fancy holes inside. And it cost $2 at a flea market in New Hampshire once. Boy, it was one of the best purchases I've ever made. An extremely elaborate thing, even though it looked simple, and it was cheap. So you never know. It's fun to have. He can afford it. It wasn't expensive. If it covers amateur radio frequencies, he'll have a direct application. Even if it doesn't, quite often the IF frequencies and intermediate frequencies and whatever within a receiver are not necessarily on hem bands. Many a really good triple conversion receiver has a 70 megahertz first IF, and in the United States, that's not a ham band. It might have an 8.9 megacycle second IF. That's not a ham band. It's got a 455 KC third IF. That's not a ham band. But this wave meter, if it operates at any of those frequencies, would allow you to do testing of a receiver. So as long as you haven't spent a lot of money and as long as you enjoy it, you haven't wasted your funds, in my opinion.
Okay.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, I have four of them. One is an HP. Basically goes from 0.01 hertz to 30 megahertz, 32 megahertz. And it's very interesting for the low-band frequencies, ELF. He'll have a lot of fun with it. Just need a long-wire antenna. They work great.
So in your case, it's a receiver that goes down to kilohertz. And I think you're saying that you maybe hear some of these kilohertz broadcasts of Loran or way back in the old days, some of the Scandinavian countries had broadcast stations. Radio 1 in Poland used to operate with a 2,150-foot high radio tower, the tallest structure mankind has ever put on planet Earth. That was close to the capital of Poland up until 1991, I think it was, when the tower collapsed because of improper maintenance. And that broadcast radio station was on the frequency in the beginning of 270 kilohertz and later on 225 kilohertz. And I bet you your radio could pick that up when Radio Poland was on the air. Is that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Absolutely, Dick. From 0.01 hertz to 32 megahertz. And what I used to do when I had it in the vehicle, I used to track down 60-cycle noise and buzzes and clips, you know, that power noises. Very useful instrument. Listen to submarines. It was an experience, but he'll have a lot of fun with it, especially if you got it cheap, because used, the HP is around $700. They were very expensive items. He'll have a ball. Raycom also made quite a few of them.
Comment?
Go right ahead.
The tower that you were mentioning was in Konstantinov in Poland, next to capital of Poland, Warsaw. And it was the radio central in Gombin, which was next to it, and that was the center of it. Now, the total height of that was 646 meters, and it was for the years of 1974 to 1991 the tallest structure in Europe. But actually, yes, it was for the certain period of time the tallest structure in the world. Now, the I believe that was in 2008, then in Haifa, they built a tower that was much larger than this one. Let's see.
Yeah, there's now a new commercial tower that in the last couple of years was completed that is taller. But for a lot of years, Radio 1 in Poland, as some people used to call it, in Konstantinov, I think is the name of the town, was the tallest structure in the world, and that broadcast station did not brag about that being the tallest structure. A lot of people knew about it, but it was kept kind of quiet. Unfortunately, after the improper maintenance took place where the tower collapsed and some people died, even though there was a great big chunk of land around it, the residents nearby in that town claimed that they were getting health problems and they wouldn't allow them to reconstruct that tower. So that broadcast station doesn't have quite the range it used to have. But it sounds to me, Mel, like that could be a fun piece of test equipment. And it sounds like the guy who bought it didn't pay a whole lot of dollars. I don't think he got stuck. I think he's going to have a lot of fun with it. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, real good. I got one more here. You want to do a real quickie?
Go for it.
Okay, I picked up another one picking up. A